This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 11th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, peace activists from the U.S. and Mexico end a nationwide caravan in Washington, D.C. and call on U.S. leaders to change drug war policies. As the U.S. marks the anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, we'll look at a federal health program's expansion to cover first responders diagnosed with cancer. And Pakistan's Hindus flee to India and seek citizenship, citing what they call persecution across the border, but their pleas reveal a complex situation. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Memorial services across the United States today mark the 11th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Matthew Petrillo was at Ground Zero.
Miley Raquel Hale.
Diane Hale McKenzie.
Nearly 3,000 people died here 11 years ago today. Their names are read to thousands at the site of the September 11th Memorial Plaza at Ground Zero.
Jay Halligan.
Readings of the names began this morning and were broken by 6 moments of silence, 4 to reflect the moments of impact of the 4 planes, and 2 to reflect when each World Trade Center tower fell.
Hargrave. My uncles, Jose Benvenido Gomez and Enrique Antonio Gomez. You guys were great fathers, great sons, great brothers, and great uncles. Our family misses you very much and love you very much. Till we meet again.
Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
Yesterday, a financial dispute was settled that will allow the privately funded construction of a 7-story subterranean memorial at the site. Once finished, it will cost $60 million a year to run. Stay tuned. We'll bring you more 9/11 news later in the program. In South Africa, another back-to-work deadline for striking miners near Johannesburg has come and gone. Thousands at the Marikana Platinum Mine, owned by UK-based Lonmin, are still on strike, and company officials say 40,000 jobs are at stake. Essohadi is a striking miner.
If that is what we are waiting for, they can come and fire us. After that, they can take their stuff back to London. They have no right to be here.
Another 15,000 miners are now striking at the nearby Goldfield Mine, as are miners at the Impala Mine. Former African National Congress youth leader Julius Malema rallied strikers today, calling for a nationwide work stoppage. In Turkey, 44 journalists were in court today, charged with alleged ties to the banned Kurdistan Workers' Party known as the PKK. This comes as clashes between the military and PKK continue to escalate, with recent months being some of the bloodiest in more than a decade. Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
About 40,000 people have been killed in the fighting between the Turkish military and Kurdish militants since the rebellion started in 1984.
People have got to stop pretending that this isn't going on. More people have been killed in the past year than have been in any year since the PKK leader Öcalan was captured in 1999.
That's Hugh Pope of the International Crisis Group, whose report today calls on the Turkish government to recognize that it must give equal rights to its sizable Kurdish minority, who seek mother language education, decentralization, and proper political representation. But according to Pope, the government continues to criminalize legitimate dissent. Activists, trade unionists, and most recently professional journalists have been swept up in the dragnet in a series of trials ongoing now. The ICG calls on the Turkish government to engage with Kurdish politicians to find a political solution that will ultimately sideline the violent hardliners within the Kurdish movement. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
As violence in Syria continues, the UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict told the Human Rights Council today there is evidence that Syrian armed forces are indiscriminately targeting children. And the World Health Organization said that access to medical care in homes has reached a crisis point.
At least 50% of medical doctors have left homes. It has been reported to WHO that there are only 3 surgeons in the whole of the governorate. At present, many of health facilities are staffed with volunteers who have no medical or health training. The Homs branch of the Syrian Red Crescent Society used to have 27 physicians employed in their polyclinics, and presently only 4 of those 27 continue to report to duty.
In Homs alone, the WHO estimates more than 550,000 people are in need of humanitarian assistance. For the first time since the outbreak of civil war in 1991, Somalia's parliament elected a new president yesterday. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
President-elect Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud won during the third round of elections, defeating incumbent President Sharif Sheikh Ahmed by a margin of over 70% of all votes cast. President-elect Hassan Sheikh is a new politician, having formed the New Peace and Development Political Party in 2010. He also helped form the Somali Institute of Management and Administration Development that aims to rebuild the war-torn nation. Mahmoud becomes the first president of the first permanent government in Somalia since 1991. The UN-backed roadmap peace process has led to the end of the transitional government in Somalia, and last month, Somali leaders signed on to an interim constitution broadening rights for Somali citizens. Mohamed Sheikh Noor, FSRN, Mogadishu.
For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. Activists from the U.S. and Mexico are in Washington, D.C. after a multi-city journey across the country to bring attention to the human cost of U.S. drug policy in Mexico. The Caravan for Peace is led by poet and father Javier Cecilia, along with others whose family members were killed by drug war violence. In D.C., the caravan is holding marches, panel discussions, and meeting with lawmakers and congressional committees today and tomorrow. They aim to use their firsthand accounts of struggle and loss to sway the officials who set policy and the taxpayers who fund it. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Lucia Baca de Moreno is one of dozens of members of the Caravan for Peace who came to Capitol Hill to put a human face on the estimated 60,000 killed and 10,000 disappeared since President Felipe Calderón took office 6 years ago.
Y si es doloroso perder un hijo, es peor.
Baca de Moreno says having a son die is painful, but not being able to find one is worse. Her 34-year-old son Alejandro was disappeared by the Zetas cartel last January in their home state of Nuevo León. Despite many investigations and some arrests, she says the federal police still don't know if he is dead or alive. She told FSRN why she and her husband Alfonso joined the Caravan for Peace in Atlanta 2 weeks ago.
Que muchos nos preguntan, ¿qué hacemos acá? ¿Por qué no pedimos la justicia que queremos en nuestro país, en
México? People ask us why we're here, why we don't demand justice from our own country, Mexico. But both governments share the responsibility. There's a plan, Mérida, where the U.S. government sends resources to Mexico. But those resources are used to kill more innocent people, like our son. We want to represent all the pain in Mexico. There are so many weapons trafficked, including assault weapons. I know the Second Amendment allowed U.S. citizens to buy guns and use them, but we want some regulation of assault weapons.
Her husband Alfonso added that he wants to challenge lawmakers to address the rampant laundering of drug money through major banks in the United States, which he says contributes to a culture of impunity that perpetuates the war.
No somos números. Somos personas. No somos estadísticas. ¿Eh? Somos personas.
Holding a laminated photo of their son, Alfonso Moreno Diaz says, we're not numbers, we're people. We're not statistics, we're people. Another caravanero on Capitol Hill Tuesday was Marta Valles Garcia. She and her family had to flee the state of Chihuahua and seek asylum in Texas last year after her sister, a public safety official, began receiving death threats from local drug cartels. She said that she had a relatively calm childhood in the border state, but a few years ago, that all changed.
Pues empezó a llegar mucha gente desconocida al municipio.
A lot of strange people began arriving in my municipality, and we started to see dead bodies.
But when the federal police and military showed up, that's when we saw the ugliest killings, the bloodiest killings. You'd be taking a stroll around the plaza and the soldiers would be walking there too. Someone would disappear and 5 minutes later, there'd be another dead body. And the federal soldiers would just cordon off the area.
Now an active member of the organization Mexicans in Exile, she said she joined the caravan when it came through El Paso last month en route to Washington, motivated by a desire to deliver a message to Congress.
I want them to think more about what they're doing, because their laws affect us. Not just exiles like me, but everyone in Mexico who has had someone in their family killed or disappeared. I want them to put themselves in our shoes and see our suffering and understand.
The caravan's visit to Capitol Hill was meant to be timed with a House Oversight Committee hearing on the Fast and Furious program. But the hearing was delayed until next week, after the release of a more than year-long study by the Inspector General got pushed back. As their 6,000-mile journey officially ends in northern D.C., the caravan's members say they'll continue to speak out against all forms of violence inflicted on the people of Mexico, from the economic violence of free trade agreements to the physical violence fueled by U.S. drug demand and gun supply. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In the hours, days, and months following the September 11th terrorist attacks, thousands of first responders and workers took part in the recovery efforts and removal of debris in Lower Manhattan. Many were exposed to harmful chemicals such as benzene, petroleum, asbestos, dioxin, and other toxic substances. Federal officials in Washington and New York downplayed the dangers of working at the site and, according to government documents and whistleblowers, concealed or misrepresented information that could have spared thousands from exposure. In 2010, after mounting pressure, lawmakers passed the Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act. Cancer was excluded from the list of illnesses at the time. That changed Monday when the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health said some 50 types of cancer would be covered for monitoring and treatment by the program. For more, we're joined by Captain Michael McPhillips. He worked in Lower Manhattan and was later diagnosed with emphysema and other illnesses. He's the Director of Social Services and Benefits with the Feel Good Foundation, an advocacy organization that aids workers from 9/11. He joins us today from New York. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, thank you so much for having us today.
The World Trade Center Health Program said it will now extend health care and compensation to those who have cancer. How does this change services now available to first responders?
Well, first of all, anybody who had cancer previously had to go outside to their own private doctors. If they didn't have some sort of medical coverage, they had to either apply for Medicare or other services. And a lot of the people that have had cancer became, you know, financially destitute because of the cost.
And now those people can be covered from the same program, the World Trade Center Health Program.
Correct. They can seek treatment at the 9/11 health spots. Hopefully they'll get better care.
And the CDC lists the cancers that are covered. They include kidney, ovary, breast, liver, esophagus, and others. What category or what types are included?
All the absorption cancers. There's 50 different types of absorption cancers.
Now, a 2011 study published in the British medical journal The Lancet found that firefighters who were exposed to these toxins after 9/11 were about 20% more likely to develop cancer. One of the difficulties with cancer is providing medical evidence of a causal link. Talk about some of the first responders your organization has worked with who have been diagnosed with cancer.
Oh my God, it's not only firefighters and policemen, it's also all the construction workers. And the fire department really has the best way to judge it because they test everybody's lungs prior to and during their entire history in the fire department. They go through rigorous medicals every single year. So by the fire department doing that, they've been able to track the increase in cancers.
Talk about your own case. How did you find out that you were sick, and how did you connect with other workers?
It was August of 2003. I was extremely lethargic. I'd been to about a dozen doctors. I could not find anything wrong with me. I went to a hepatologist who found out that I had end-stage liver disease. And I started getting treatment. I had no idea it was 9/11 related. I just thought I got sick.
So you were down there the days following 9/11?
I was down there on 9/11. New York Waterway belonged to OEM, which was the Office of Emergency Management for New York City. And we started taking families down to the site every day so they could see where their loved ones were passed. And we started doing the troop movement. We had a barge right there at Ground Zero, commuters. And then we took over, because the PATH train was down, we had to take over the ridership for the PATH.
The PATH that goes from New York to New Jersey.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
At that point, in the days first following the attacks, was there any concern that there was something dangerous in the air, that people could get sick from this?
No, the EPA director actually came out and said the air was safe, but we were told that the air was safe and there was nothing to worry about.
What's next for your fight on this issue? You mentioned the question of funding and how, in order to originally even get the bill passed, you had to cut the funding in half. And now with this extension, there's a concern about how many resources could be put towards it. What's next?
I think the next thing will be really to start going back down to Washington and ask them to increase the funding. So we really have to go back down to Washington and try to get it increased. We need everybody in the United States and anywhere else to call and help us, because we really need it.
Captain Michael McPhillips joined us from New York. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Today, teachers in Chicago entered their second day of a strike. Negotiations are continuing, but the Chicago Teachers Union says it's not willing to compromise on compensation, job security, classroom conditions, and policies that link teacher evaluations to student test scores. FSRN's Jessel Noor brings us more from Chicago.
Thousands of people flooded into downtown Chicago to show their support for striking teachers, wearing red, white, and blue Teachers Union t-shirts. Demonstrators occupied several city blocks for hours as teachers and activists addressed the crowd and protesters chanted their support. As negotiations continue, officials with Chicago Public Schools say the two sides are close to an agreement, but the 27,000-strong Chicago Teachers Union rejected the city's latest offer. Among the union's supporters is 17-year-old Social Justice High senior Karen Canales.
I'm here today mainly because when CPS did some drastic changes to our school and our classes, we as students protested and fought back. And the teachers showed their support with us, and I'm here to support them. But not only because they want a fair pay, but they want to fight for our classrooms, and that's why I'm here, because I'm part of a classroom.
Also attending the rally was Canales' English teacher, Angela Sangha. She says the citywide teacher strike is partially motivated by growing frustration about the lack of student, teacher, and parental input, something that she's experienced at Social Justice High.
If we had the kinds of accountability for what decisions principals can make in terms of the learning environment of students, that our union wouldn't need to fight the way it is fighting. That right now, the power that the principal has is really unchecked. And I think that if we have a contract that that really outlines what specifically our students deserve and the kinds of environment that, you know, teachers and staff and kids and parents can be in and really function, that's what this fight is about.
Sangha was recently laid off by the school. It all started in early August when school officials fired Social Justice High's principal, Kathy Farr, who was chosen in February by a local school council. The new principal immediately changed the students' schedule and canceled several advanced placement classes. She also fired another longtime teacher, Katie Logan. School officials cited financial reasons and did not provide further explanation.
After Katie and I were fired, it was very clear that this fight would have to take place with the community and students.
Students, including Karen Canales, responded swiftly, organizing direct actions and sit-ins.
It was throughout a whole week we were striking, and then finally on the Friday of that week, we did a march that we got a lot of support from the community members.
Parents also protested, filling meeting rooms and petitioning the principal. The teachers' union threatened the city with legal action. The actions forced officials to reinstate teachers Sangha and Logan, along with the advanced placement classes. But the school community also wants the principal they chose, Kathy Farr, to get her job back.
The attack at Sojo is in a sense very similar to the attack on the teachers' movement.
Rico Gutstein is a professor of education at the University of Illinois at Chicago and was on the design team of Social Justice High.
What's happened in Sojo is an attack on the community, which is also an attack on the teachers. They fired teachers. It's an attack on the students. It's an attack on the parents as well. What we see here is a teachers' union that is fighting for the unity of community, students, parents, teachers, and the union itself in a new day and a new possibility in Chicago.
Contract negotiations are expected to continue until late Tuesday night. If no agreement is reached, teachers will be back on the picket lines. Jessel Noor, FSRN, Chicago.
For years in South Asia, national borders, religion, and local politics have made for tense relations, especially between Pakistan and India. Now, hundreds of Hindu families are leaving their homes in Pakistan to settle in India. Many of them arrived on pilgrimage visas in the past few weeks and are demanding Indian citizenship. They say they're being persecuted on religious grounds in Pakistan, and the situation isn't safe. Their flight has brought renewed focus on the safety of minorities living in Pakistan, but the families also face an uncertain future in India. FSRN's Bismillah Galani reports from New Delhi.
Samjhota Express is one of only two trains running between India and Pakistan. It travels twice a week and is an important link connecting the two neighbors that share a common culture and history. It brings together thousands of families separated by the British partition 65 years ago and is also used by those wishing to visit religious holy places, becoming a source of spiritual comfort. That's why it's also called a friendship train. But these days, many of those arriving from Pakistan bring along tales of hate and horror. They are Hindus who say they are being persecuted because of their religion. Mukesh Ahuja, a businessman from Pakistan's Balochistan province, is one of them.
We face a lot of problems there. Our homes and shops are looted in broad daylight. People barge into our houses and shops and take away cash and jewelry. Our children are being abducted from schools. The situation is worsening with every passing day. And it seems in the coming days, the only way for us to save ourselves would be to convert to Islam.
Another passenger on the train is Suman Kumari, who is from Karachi, the capital of Sindh province. She says the situation is particularly dangerous for women who are being forcibly converted to Islam and married against their will.
It is much worse in Karachi. The women there are totally unsafe. They are being targeted frequently and face a lot of violence. Those of us who have managed to cross over don't want to go back.
According to Pakistan Hindu Council, Pakistan has more than 7 million Hindu citizens, forming nearly 2% of the country's total population. But in recent years, a spate of kidnappings, murders, and alleged forced conversions have left the community with a deep sense of insecurity. G. Parthasarthi is former Indian ambassador to Pakistan. He blames growing religious extremism in Pakistan for the situation.
Of late, according to Sindh government records, police records, 25 Hindu girls are forcibly converted every month in Sindh. You know, I was in Sindh in the 80s, and this sort of thing never happened. This is a manifestation of Wahhabi fundamentalism. One is seeing increasing Wahhabi radicalization, which is exclusive in Pakistan. It goes against the grain of Islamic beliefs, which have traditionally been a feature of the subcontinent.
But senior Pakistani journalist Hamid Mir says it's not religious groups that are targeting Hindus.
Religious extremism is more in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Punjab. But in both these regions, the Hindus and Sikhs live in peace. Even in some tribal areas, which are traditional Taliban strongholds, these people don't have any problems. They don't have problems with the Taliban either. The attacks on them are taking place mainly in Sindh and Balochistan, which are comparatively liberal and secular societies. And it's the criminal elements who target them because Hindus in these areas are economically well-off, educated, and are mostly a business community.
More than 300 Pakistani Hindu families have arrived in India in recent weeks. An equal number are already here, overstaying their visas. Many of them are seeking Indian citizenship. Lawmakers in both countries discussed the issue in Parliament, while the Pakistani government set up a commission to look into the matter. Some Indian MPs demanded that India directly take up the issue with Pakistan. The main opposition Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP also urged the government to grant the Hindu families all the assistance they need, including Indian citizenship. Rajnath Singh is a senior BJP leader.
The government of India should immediately summon the Pakistani ambassador in India and express its displeasure and concern over the treatment of Hindus in Pakistan. The government should also talk to other nations and bring international pressure on Pakistan to ensure the safety and security of minorities in Pakistan.
Analysts, however, say India shouldn't interfere, as it may threaten improving relations between the two neighbors. Meanwhile, the Indian government says it's willing to issue long-term visas to Pakistani Hindus wishing to stay in India. The government, however, did not specify the number of such visas. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.